Covenant is not a word that we use very much today. We normally talk about contracts or agreements or something. But in reality, there are various types of covenants that we enter into, but we don't use the terminology very much anymore. For example, marriage. Marriage. Here's just a thought question for you in a small group. Turn to someone next to you. Does God, this is not man, but does God consider marriage a conditional or an unconditional covenant? Is it a two-way or is it only a one-way covenant in marriage? Thought question for you to talk to someone next to you, all right? You guys, the three of you can talk together. We'll put all the men in one group here and you ladies can talk to each other. A marriage between a husband and wife, are they making an unconditional covenant when they are married, or are they making a conditional covenant?
Conditional
means there are conditions that they can break the covenant. They can break the covenant if there's a, if the other person, let's say, doesn't hold to it. Unconditional means whether the other person holds to it or not, I'm still going to be faithful to this covenant. Maybe we can go like this, you two talk, all right? We'll put Keshi together with Robin. You two talk. That way everybody's talking with one person, all right? If you're listening to this at home, I want you to think about this yourself. Think of your own life, your own marriage, if you're married or if you're not married. What kind of covenant are you willing to go on into if you get married? Are you willing to commit yourself unconditionally to someone? For those that are married, we should look back and say to ourselves, well, what type of agreement did I make with my spouse? Did you mention the word divorce in your marriage vows? What did you mean when you said, or did you not say, till death do us part? Okay, friends, I'm curious as to what you all said. You may not have agreed with the person next to you. But how many of you said that marriage is a conditional covenant? Put your hands up. Do you say that it's a conditional covenant? Okay, that's 7 out of 8 here. And Erin, would you say it's unconditional?
Unconditional.
Okay. Are you married?
Yes.
Would your husband agree with you? I hope so, right? For those of us who are married, this might be maybe you shouldn't ask this question, huh? I've been married for 35 years. I think if I asked my wife, she'd say, well, we said till death do us part, didn't we? You know, I think that's what she'd say to me. She'll say, I made this unconditional covenant to you. In fact, we've often talked about if one of us passes away, because we've had several of our friends, they've lost husband or wife just this year, and they're our age. You know, they're in their 60s, and you think you're going to live into your 80s or 90s or whatever. Our parents are all turning 90 next year. So I tend to think, well, I told Susan, I said, hey, I've been married to you for 35 years. Expect to put up with me for at least another 30 years. But she says, well, if you die, I don't think I'll ever remarry. And I said, well, I don't know if I would make that commitment, but I will be committed to you until my death, you know. Yeah, what's your thought?
Yeah. If you say unconditional, I'm thinking of the
trend that the world is going. And if you keep it unconditional, wouldn't it be giving too much of leverage and freedom for one party to not be committed? I think.
So if you're unconditionally committed, then you're opening yourself up to the other person not really being a very good spouse. Shall we sin so that grace may abound?
Because when you say conditional, I think equally both parties need to abide by the sin conditions. And if not, one party might take
we all agree that both parties need to abide by the same conditions.
Because it's not only until the divorce part. There's a lot more proceeding.
Yeah, I find it interesting. We never hear the word divorce in the marriage vows. Nobody says, you know, for richer, for poorer, for, you know, in sickness and in health, till death or divorce. Part, do us part. Nobody ever says that in their marriage vows, at least that I've ever heard. Have you ever heard anyone say that in a wedding before? We don't ever mention that, but I wonder what perspective we actually have in it. When I got married, I told my wife in the wedding vows, I didn't really like these archaic wedding vows. And heretofore I bequeath thee my troth. What in the world is that? Couldn't even say it, you know. So I was always, I thought, let's just say it like it is, you know. That's kind of my personality, I guess. And so I said it in our wedding vows. I said, Susan, before God and these witnesses, I vow that I will never divorce you, nor will I ever consider it an option. When I said it like that, you could hear the proverbial pin drop in the back. I don't know if anyone there, we had about almost 400 people at our wedding. I don't know if anyone had ever heard it said that way before. But I wanted it to have the impact because I wanted people to realize, I wanted especially my wife to realize, I'm committing myself to you. We're not even going to talk about divorce is not a word that we use in our vocabulary. We never ever say, well, if we ever get a divorce, I think that's a very not a wise way to conduct a marriage. If we ever get a divorce, then you're just opening the can of worms, so to speak. So anyway, so you can see where I'm at on it. I'm thinking unconditional, that there's no conditions here, but most of you are thinking conditions.
When you talk about the marriage relationship, also it talks about Jesus and the church. That's the metaphor. So
That is the model, Christ's commitment to the church.
So definitely it's unconditional. That's the superior, that's the only relationship and the covenant that can demonstrate on a
Let's talk about this more. Let's talk about this when we take our break. This will be really fuel for discussion over some tea.
It is, but practically, many instances where so we're talking about practicality as well.
Yeah.
Because I'm a marriage counselor, mm-hmm. and I sit with couples every day, and there are times where even as a Christian counselor and a pastor, I have to think twice to. Openly, I can't say that divorce is the option, but if the husband is very abusive and repeatedly unfaithful, and also on top of that, I mean, literally, I've been with people like that. So in my heart, I've been wondering, should we still say no, continue?
Yeah.
And it's very harmful physically, emotionally, mentally. I'm sitting with women who are tormented by their husbands.
We need to listen to that. I guess I can tell you that since I was married, I also have changed my view on that in terms of whether there are biblical grounds for divorce. So I would say yes now that adultery and desertion by an unbelieving partner, you find in 1 Corinthians 7. So we need to hold to the ideal, but we need to also deal with reality, I guess is what you're saying, right?
Exactly.
That's, I think we would agree on that. Would we agree, Erin?
Yeah.
Yeah. We all realize that we live in a fallen world, and divorce is not, that's not God's, it's not God's will. But we also see that people just headlong just go into sin, committing atrocities before God and ruining lives. I've seen it happen in my ministry. You've seen it happen in your ministry. And I don't want this to be a marriage session necessarily. I just wanted to get us started off and thinking about the difference between conditional and unconditional, and to realize we have different types of agreements. All right? I could make an unconditional commitment to someone, let's say, to give that person land. That would be what the king did in antiquity. It was called the royal land grant. He wanted to show favor to a person, and he says, here's this land, no conditions attached. But there was also a conditional type of covenant at the time of Abraham, and that was also called the suzerain-vassal covenant. The suzerain was the greater king, and he would make a covenant with a lesser king or lesser nation, a weaker nation, and say, I'm going to provide protection for you, but I'm expecting you to do something too. I'm expecting you to give me 20% of your crops. I'm expecting you to, you know, whatever it might be. It's all spelled out in the contract. And this is what we normally think of when we think of contracts today. We think of conditional covenants, conditional agreements. So if you break the covenant, it's all spelled out. This is what's going to happen. Those are two basic types of covenants. And having that understanding, we need to see, well, what is the scripture actually talking about? There's, even in conditional covenants, there's different ways to ratify the covenant. Verbally, shaking hands on it, taking your sandal off, and giving it to the other person, we see in Ruth chapter 4, or a written covenant, that's the one we're talking about here. A written covenant can be among equals. It's called a parity covenant. It would be like for you and me, as just as individuals, we can make such a covenant. Unless you think of me as the suzerain, since I'm the teacher and you're the student. I don't think of there being this great distance between us, like I'm the great king or anything like that. But these are different types of ancient covenants. A parity covenant would, for example, be like Hiram of Lebanon making a covenant with Solomon to provide these logs for the temple. They're equal kings, if you will. Whereas the suzerain vassal covenant actually comes from the Hittite kingdom on modern-day Turkey. They were the fierce lords or the suzerains who forced their servant nations, the vassal nations, to submit to their rule. Now, how does all this relate to the Mosaic covenant? It's interesting. The critical scholars of the 1800s said that the language and structure of Deuteronomy is too advanced for Moses to have written it in the 15th century. So it must have been written much later by others in the 8th century, like under King Josiah. This is too advanced, they said. And then, that was the 1800s. When we get into the 1900s, all these archaeological discoveries started coming out. We have these vast discoveries of the Hittite treaties. And lo and behold, the Hittite treaty formula of six different sections is the exact formula we find in the book of Deuteronomy, of the time of Moses. Do you see how this argues for Moses actually being the author of Deuteronomy? He was using this six-part structure that was common in his day, even as you and I would make a covenant today, we'd use the same kind of accepted contract structure that we would is commonplace in our society today. It starts with the preamble introducing the treaty. That's exactly what we've got in Deuteronomy. It gives the historical prologue showing the background. The relationship between the two parties. That's what Moses does in chapters 1 to 4. It has the general stipulation, which is generally a call for obedience. In Deuteronomy, it's a call to love the Lord. Here's your general stipulation. And then the specific stipulations then follow with detailed laws required of the vassal to show allegiance to the king. This is what we find in Deuteronomy chapters 12 to 26. And then divine witnesses were called to witness the treaty, calling on this God and that God. Well, God's not going to do that. There's no God greater than him. So he calls heaven and earth to witness. And then the last part has the blessings and the cursings. If you obey the covenant, this is what's going to result. If you disobey the treaty, these curses are going to come about. This is exactly what we find in Deuteronomy, especially chapter 28. Chapters 27, 28. Then there's a covenant summary, and normally the blessings and the cursings will end with, okay, where are we going to put this document? That would be written into it. We see that, and who's going to actually be the next person, the covenant mediator to follow, which we find Joshua to be that covenant mediator to follow.
So 27 and 28, is that conditional?
Yes. So this is a great illustration of the Mosaic Covenant being a conditional covenant. So the Mosaic Covenant, it would fit under the suzerain vassal covenant, not the royal land grant. What we have in the royal land grant is God making this covenant to Abraham much earlier, 600 years earlier than Moses, where the Lord said to Abraham, leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land. Doesn't that sound like royal land grant? And over God says, I will, I will, I will. I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless those who bless you. I'll curse those who curse you. And all peoples of the earth will be blessed through you. We actually have three promises, land, seed, and a blessing in that promise.
But it's conditions. If you leave your country.
Some would say this is a conditional covenant because God is saying you have to leave. Abraham did leave. Actually, you'll notice that this, I believe, is in the New International Version. Notice verse 1, the Lord had said to Abram. In other words, this is looking back earlier. This is what God had already done after Abraham had already left. Abraham was living in the land of Haran, not in Ur. He had already left by the time he had done this. And God made this covenant with him. There's an unconditional nature to it, land, seed, and blessing, LSB, an unconditional promise later to become a legal covenant. And notice how many times the I will statements appear. It's not a, if you will do this, then I will do this. It's not like that. It's the I will statements. As such, I believe what we've got in the Abrahamic covenant is an unconditional covenant. And so I don't actually have any problems seeking to contrast these two. I'm going to jump to slide 45 and then we'll take a break here. The Abrahamic covenant is the I will and the unconditionals in Genesis 12. The Mosaic covenant, if you'll do this, then I'll do this. We find this over and over in the covenant. And so we have the conditions talked about there. You can contrast these two in many different ways. The Abrahamic covenant, for example, is universal in its scope. All peoples will be blessed through you. Whereas the Mosaic covenant, only Israel received the law. We don't have any other nation that received the Mosaic law. We have promises for blessing for obedience and cursings for disobedience. We don't have that as part of the Abrahamic covenant. In fact, Abraham was asleep when God ratified the covenant, whereas Israel was very much awake there at Mount Sinai with the mountain on fire, and they're going, oh, God, you talk, you know, Moses, why don't you talk to God for us? You know, they were, for those of you who are not married, I advise you, if you're going to get married, be very much awake during your wedding. Don't be sleeping through the vows, right? You should be very much awake. The analogy is father to son like a royal land grant in the Abrahamic covenant. The analogy of the Mosaic covenant is a suzerain to vassal. God is the superior king and Israel is the vassal nation.
Even though Mosaic covenant is based on Abrahamic covenant.
I think the Mosaic covenant has the Abrahamic covenant as its foundation.
Yeah.
They already have this relationship with God. God has established. But these are stipulations for a period of time when God's dealing with the people of Israel. And so I would say as a result, when the cross of Christ comes, the Mosaic covenant actually ends. This is the application of it. In other words, I believe that we are not under the Mosaic covenant. This is where it shows up in our lives today. You have all these contrasts, I believe, in your notes on page 51, if that page number is correct. We have a different sign of the Abrahamic covenant. That was circumcision. The sign of the Mosaic covenant is the Sabbath. So as a such, I don't believe that believers need to be following the Saturday Sabbath anymore. I think most of you would agree with me on that. Because probably you don't have your church services on Saturday. You probably do them on Sunday. So those would be some of the practical ramifications of it. One last thing, and then I'll give you the break. And that is, I have this very detailed chart here, covenant, a timeline on page 50, that puts the two covenants together, where we have, I'll avoid the kingdom part at the top right now, but just say on the Abrahamic covenant, you've got the land covenant, Davidic covenant, and the new covenant actually coming out of that covenant and continuing on all the way to the eternal kingdom. God is going to keep this unconditional covenant forever with Israel and with us as we are brought on into the covenant. Whereas the Mosaic covenant you have there at the bottom of the chart, it starts after the Abrahamic covenant. It starts with the law being given under Moses, 1400 BC, 1450 BC or so. And it goes all the way until the cross. When Jesus died, the law was abolished, fulfilled, and replaced at the cross. You see this in Romans, you see this in 1 Corinthians 9, Hebrews. In fact, the Colossians 2 says he nailed to the cross the covenant. I could add that as well. In fact, if Hebrews 8:13 says what is obsolete will soon be done away with, which is quite interesting. The writer of Hebrews was saying this whole system, tabernacle system, or temple system would soon be done away with, and it soon was, because the whole temple system was destroyed shortly after the writing of the book of the Hebrews, in the 60s. So we have an old covenant that is now replaced with the new covenant, slide 44. And this old covenant was glorious and wonderful, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 3, but it's replaced by the new covenant, which is even more glorious and more wonderful in many, many different ways that Paul enumerates that I've just put on this chart. So that's what we have. And the question for us is, which covenant are we seeking to live under? The old covenant or the new covenant? May I encourage you to live your life as believers in the new covenant, under the new covenant.